Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Juvenile Miranda Rights Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 23, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in JDB versus North Carolina, a case concerning the standard used to determine when a suspect must be advised of his or her Miranda rights. A person generally is not entitled to Miranda warnings until that person is to be subjected to questioning while in police custody. A person is usually considered to be in police custody if a reasonable person in the same circumstances would believe that he or she is not free to terminate the police questioning and leave. The question in the JDB case is whether a court should consider the age of a juvenile suspect when determining whether the juvenile was in custody for Miranda purposes. To discuss the case, we have Carissa Byrne-Hessick, who is an associate professor at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Hessick.
Hello, my name is Carissa Byrne-Hessick, and I'm on the faculty at the Arizona State University College of Law. I'm going to be talking to you today about JDB versus North Carolina. JDB versus North Carolina is a Miranda case pending before the United States Supreme Court this term. It presents the question whether a juvenile suspect's age is a relevant consideration when determining whether that suspect is in custody for Miranda purposes. Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar with Miranda versus Arizona, the 1966 case that requires law enforcement officers to give suspects the familiar warnings. That is, you have the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, et cetera, et cetera. Now, law enforcement don't have to give Miranda warnings every single time that they talk to a suspect. Warnings are only required if the suspect is in custody and if he or she is being interrogated. Because custodial interrogation triggers Miranda warnings, and its attendant rights. Over the years, a significant amount of case law has been decided regarding when a suspect is considered to be in custody and the types of police-suspect interactions that constitute interrogation. Previous Supreme Court decisions dictate that a suspect is in custody if she is subject to formal arrest or to restraint on freedom of movement of the degree associated with formal arrest. JDB involves the second type of situation. In particular, it asks, was the juvenile defendant subject to a restraint on his freedom of movement of the degree associated with formal arrest? And like all cases that have to answer this type of question, the ultimate outcome in JDB versus North Carolina will involve an analysis of the facts surrounding the interrogation. So let me tell you a little bit about the facts surrounding the interrogation in this case. On September 24, 2005, two homes were burglarized in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. JDB, the petitioner in this case, was identified as a possible suspect in those burglaries. A police officer saw him and another boy looking into a window of one of the two homes that was burglarized. The officer questioned JDB, as well as his aunt and grandmother, who apparently expressed hostility towards the officer and indicated that they believed the questioning was racially motivated. The police department assigned a juvenile investigator to the case. Several days later, when one of the items stolen in the burglaries, a digital camera, was found at a local middle school, the juvenile investigator visited the school. He asked the school to verify JDB's date of birth, as well as the address and telephone number for his legal guardian. The investigator interviewed two witnesses who said they'd seen JDB with the camera and then proceeded to interview JDB himself. At the time of the interrogation, JDB was a 13-year-old seventh grader, and he was enrolled in special education classes. JDB was escorted from his class to a conference room, which contained the juvenile investigator, a uniformed police officer who was assigned to the school as a resource officer, the vice principal of the school, and the vice principal's intern. After JDB entered the room, the door was closed but not locked. Before formally beginning the interview, the juvenile investigator engaged JDB in small talk. He then asked JDB whether he would answer some questions about the recent burglaries, and JDB acquiesced. Much of the questioning involved Paula Hemmer. JDB had previously been paid by Hemmer to mow her lawn, but when Hemmer lost her job, she informed JDB that she would not be able to hire him for the rest of the year. Hemmer's was one of the homes that had been burglarized. During the interview, JDB told the juvenile investigator that he and his friend had been in the neighborhood looking for work mowing lawns. He said that they'd gone to Hemmer's house because Hemmer was a regular customer. When Hemmer wasn't home, he said that they visited other houses looking for work. The juvenile investigator told JDB that he knew Hemmer had lost her job and that she had told him that she was unable to hire him for the rest of the year. JDB did not respond. Then the juvenile investigator told JDB that he had the stolen camera, and the resource officer showed JDB the camera. JDB remained quiet. At that point, the vice principal of the school encouraged JDB to, quote, do the right thing because the truth always comes out in the end. JDB asked, if he got the stuff back, was he still going to be in trouble? The juvenile investigator replied that it would help to get the items back, but that this thing is going to court. He also explained that a secure custody order could be obtained if the juvenile investigator felt that JDB was going to go out and break into other people's houses again. JDB asked what a secure custody order was, and the juvenile investigator explained that it's where you get sent to juvenile detention before court. At that point, the juvenile investigator told JDB that he didn't have to talk to him and that if he wanted to leave, he could do so. But he added that he hoped JDB would listen to what he had to say. The juvenile investigator also asked JDB whether he understood that he was not under arrest and that he didn't have to talk to him, and JDB nodded his head yes. JDB then admitted that he and his friend went into one of the houses and took a camera, a cell phone, and some jewelry. The juvenile investigator proceeded to question JDB and got additional information from him and asked JDB to write down a written statement detailing what happened with the burglaries. When the bell rang, signaling the end of the school day, the juvenile investigator advised JDB to go ahead and take the bus home as he ordinarily would and that he would meet him in his house later. He then did that, obtained a search warrant, and executed the search warrant. Now, JDB's aunt and grandmother, his legal guardian, weren't at home that afternoon when the warrant was executed, and they were not contacted before or during the interrogation at school. Now, these facts were used by the lower courts, the trial court and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of North Carolina. They went through these facts and performed the sort of analysis that you would ordinarily see in a Miranda case involving a question of custody. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, although it may eventually discuss these facts and discuss whether JDB in particular was in custody for Miranda purposes, the particular question that the United States Supreme Court has granted certiorari on is whether the trial court should have considered the fact that JDB was a juvenile. Now, before I get to the specific arguments that the parties have raised before the court, it's important that you understand the court's prior cases in this area. In particular, that the court has previously explained that the custody determination for Miranda purposes is an objective inquiry. The custody determination is an objective determination because it's based on a reasonable person inquiry. As the court explained in Yarborough versus Alvarado, a 2004 case, two discrete inquiries are essential to the custody determination. First, what were the circumstances surrounding the interrogation? And second, given those circumstances, would a reasonable person have felt that he or she was not at liberty to terminate the interrogation and leave? The court explained in Stansbury versus California, a 1994 case, that, quote, the initial determination of custody depends on the objective circumstances of the interrogation, not on the subjective views harbored by either the interrogating officers or the person being questioned. And the court has also explained that an objective test for whether a suspect is in custody is preferable to a subjective test, in part because it does not place upon the police the burden of anticipating the frailties or idiosyncrasies of every person whom they question. So, at this point you might be asking, what are the criteria that the court has considered when applying this reasonable person standard? Well, it's looked at the location of the interrogation. Police stations are considered more custodial than a suspect's home. It's looked at the use of force or restraints. Placing a suspect in handcuffs, for example, may result in a finding of custody. It has looked at the length of the interview, longer interrogations being more suggestive of custody than shorter ones, and it has looked at the number of officers present. So what criteria has the court indicated are irrelevant in determining whether a person is in custody under the reasonable person test? Well, in California versus Baylor, the court said that the lower court erred in considering the fact that the defendant had been drinking earlier in the day and was emotionally distraught in determining whether he was in custody. And in Yarborough versus Alvarado, the court held that a defendant's lack of prior criminal justice experience was irrelevant to the custody inquiry. The Yarborough is also an important case because it addressed the relevance of a defendant's age to the custody question in the context of a habeas petition. Relevant law dictates that a federal court can grant an application for a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of a person held pursuant to a state court judgment if the state court adjudication resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, clearly established federal law being determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. In Yarborough, the Ninth Circuit had held that state courts had erred in deciding that the defendant had not been in custody during an interrogation because it failed to account for the defendant's youth and his lack of experience in the criminal justice system when evaluating whether a reasonable person in his position would have felt free to leave. The Yarborough court reversed the Ninth Circuit, noting that, quote, our opinions applying the Miranda custody test have not mentioned the suspect's age, much less mandated its consideration. Now, given the legal standard for habeas petitions, this statement alone was likely enough to overturn the Ninth Circuit. But the Yarborough court went on to state, there is an important conceptual difference between the Miranda custody test and the line of cases from other contexts considering age and experience. The Miranda custody inquiry is an objective test. The objective Miranda custody inquiry could reasonably be viewed as different from doctrinal tests that depend on the actual mindset of a particular suspect, where we do consider a suspect's age and experience. For example, the voluntariness of a statement is often said to depend on whether the defendant's will was overborne, a question that logically can depend on the characteristics of the accused. The characteristics of the accused can include the suspect's age, education, and intelligence, as well as a suspect's prior experience with law enforcement. In concluding that there was no principled reason why such factors should not also apply to the Miranda custody inquiry, the Court of Appeals ignored the argument that the custody inquiry states an objective rule designed to give clear guidance to the police, while consideration of a suspect's individual characteristics, including his age, could be viewed as creating a subjective inquiry. Now, as you might imagine, the parties in JDB disagree whether a suspect's age is an objective or a subjective factor. And as you also might imagine, the respondent, the state of North Carolina, relies heavily on the dicta from Yarborough that I just read to you. In particular, the petitioner argues that the age is an objective factor because the appropriate inquiry is not what this particular defendant felt or thought during the interrogation, but rather what a reasonable suspect of a similar age would have thought during this interrogation. And the petitioner points to several other tests where we talk about the reasonable 13-year-old, such as in tort cases involving negligence. The respondent, on the other hand, consistently refers to a suspect's age as a subjective factor. But the actual argument made in support of this assertion by the respondents isn't particularly strong. Their brief says, quote, while officers may in some instances, as in this case, know the age of the person they are questioning, the subjective effect of that person's age on his or her perception of custody is internal to that person rather than a factor that can be easily perceived by the officers. As a result, consideration of a suspect's individual characteristics, including his age, could be viewed as creating a subjective inquiry. Now, this doesn't seem to be as strong as an argument as the petitioner is making about how you can craft an argument involving the reasonable 13-year-old. But the respondent does have a stronger argument in their brief, and it's an argument that I think is aimed at those justices who don't seem to be particularly enamored of the Miranda test. In particular, the respondents focus on the fact that Miranda was intended to give law enforcement officers clear guidelines to use, and that the court over the years has refused to sanction attempts to expand the Miranda holding. The respondents go on to state that easily perceived circumstances external to the person being interviewed can be assessed quickly by officers. It's not difficult for officers to understand the effect of handcuffs on a suspect, a locked door, or even the impact that hours of questioning would have on a person's view of whether he or she was free to leave. By contrast, how a 13-year-old suspect would react to certain circumstances compared to a 17-year-old suspect would be difficult for officers to determine without knowing more about the mindset of that person. Now, perhaps the best argument against the petitioner's claim that age is an objective factor can be found in the amicus brief of the United States. The United States in their amicus brief states that although age is objective in the narrow sense, that someone's birth date precisely determines how old he is, that's not the sense in which the petitioner is employing the term here. Petitioner is instead using the term age as a stand-in for a set of age-correlated factors that may render a child particularly susceptible to the coercive techniques of police interrogation. Psychological factors such as age, however, affect the suspect's mental analysis of the situation. There would be no way to account for them other than to transform the reasonable person test into something else in an attempt to approximate the suspect's thought processes. Now, in addition to the argument about whether age is an objective or a subjective factor, complicating all of this analysis is the fact that a suspect's age is one of the factors that is considered relevant in other interrogation-related inquiries, such as whether there's been an appropriate Miranda waiver, or whether the confession was given voluntarily. Petitioner argues that because age is considered in these other inquiries, the concerns raised by the respondent regarding lack of clarity or difficulties for law enforcement must be overblown. And the respondent counters that the inclusion of age as a factor for these other inquiries means that concerns about coercion and juveniles are already adequately accounted for. Now, people usually don't talk about U.S. Supreme Court cases without closing with a prediction. But at the time this podcast is being recorded, the court has not yet heard arguments in JDB versus North Carolina. Now, because the justices' questions and oral argument often give us insight into how various justices are leaning, I'm very hesitant to offer any predictions without the benefit of having listened to that argument. But I do, before closing, want to note two recent court trends that make this case a case to watch and that may ultimately play a role in how the votes break down in this case. The first trend is a trend involving Miranda generally. The Roberts Court has granted certiorari in several cases over the past several years, and each of them has been decided in a way that narrows rather than expands Miranda rights. That trend is an important trend because this is obviously a Miranda case and because the respondents make a strong argument that deciding the case in petitioner's favor expands the Miranda remedy. But there is a competing line of cases that may bump up against the general trend to narrow Miranda, and that's a trend of cases involving juveniles in the criminal justice system. In the sentencing context, in particular in Graham versus Florida, and Roper versus Simmons, the court has demonstrated that it's especially protective of juveniles in the criminal justice system. In those cases, the court has relied on social science data showing that juveniles' brain development is not the same as adult brain development, and the court has relied on those studies in deciding that rules for juveniles in the sentencing context ought to be different. This case also points to social science data suggesting that juveniles react to interrogations differently than adults do. In particular, the petitioners cite a study that demonstrates that juveniles under the age of 16 are significantly more likely to comply with adult authority in a legal setting and to confess to police. Now, those justices on the court who've been particularly solicitous of juvenile rights, notably Justice Kennedy, may find this social science data compelling and may ultimately be swayed by it in voting in this case. So that's your recap of JDB versus North Carolina. It's certainly an interesting case and a case to watch. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.